chamber above a storeroom with several other men, since Fru Gunna was sharing Kristen's bed. And he flew into a rage. He grabbed Kristen by the arm so hard that the marks from his fingers were still on her skin. "Do you think my daughter should be lying on straw and homespun cloth? Margaret is mine, even though she may not be yours. What's not good enough for your own children is good enough for her. But since you've mocked the innocent little maiden in the sight of these women, then you must rectify matters before their eyes. Put back the covers that you took from Margaret." It so happened that Erland had been drunk the night before, and he was always bad-tempered the following day. And no doubt he thought the women must have been gossiping among themselves when they saw Elena's children. And he grew sensitive and testy about their reputation. And yet, Kristen had tried to talk to Cira Eilev about it. But he couldn't help her with this matter. Gunnulf had told her that she need not mention the sins to which she had confessed and repented before Eilev Sirkson became her parish priest, unless she thought that he should know about them in order to judge and advise her. So there were many things she had never told him, even though she felt that by not doing so, she would seem, in Cira Eilev's eyes, to be a better person than she was. But it was so good for her to have the friendship of this kind and pure-hearted man. Erland made fun of her, but she gained such comfort from Cira Eilev. With him, she could talk as much as she liked about her children. The priest was willing to discuss with her all the small bits of news that bored Erland and drove him from the room. The priest got on well with children, and he understood their small troubles and illnesses. Erland laughed at Kristen when she went to the cookhouse herself to prepare special dishes, which she would send over to the parsonage. Cira Eilev was fond of good food and drink, and it amused Kristen to spend time on such matters and to try out what she had learned from her mother or seen at the convent. Erland didn't care what he ate as long as he was always served meat if it wasn't a time for fasting. But Cira Eilev would come over to talk and thank her, praising her skill after she had sent him grouse on a spit, wrapped in the best bacon, or a platter of reindeer tongues in French wine and honey. And he gave her advice about her garden, obtaining cuttings for her from Tautra, where his brother was a monk, and from the Olav Monastery, whose prior was a good friend of his. And he also read to her and could recount so many wonderful things about life out in the world. But because he was such a good and pious man, it was often difficult to speak to him about the evil she saw in her own heart. When she confessed to him how embittered she felt at Erland's behavior that day with Margaret, he had impressed upon her that she must bear with her husband. But he seemed to think that Erland alone had committed an offense when he spoke so unjustly to his wife, and in the presence of strangers. Kristen doubtless agreed with him. And yet, deep in her heart, she felt a complicity which she could not explain and which caused her great pain. Kristen looked up at the holy shrine, which glittered a dull gold in the dim light behind the high altar. She had been so certain that if she stood here again, something would happen. A redemption of her soul. Once more a living fount would surge up into her heart and wash away all the anguish and fear and bitterness and confusion that filled her. But no one had any patience for her tonight. "Haven't you learned yet, Kristen, to lift your self-righteousness to the light of God's righteousness, your heathen and selfish passion to the light of love? Perhaps you do not want to learn it, Kristen." But the last time she knelt here, she had held Nokve in her arms. His little mouth at her breast warmed her heart so well that it was like soft wax, easy for the heavenly love to shape. And she did have Nokve. He was playing back home in the hall, so lovely and sweet that her breast ached at the mere thought of him. His soft curly hair was now turning dark. He was going to have black hair like his father. And he was so full of life and mischief. She made animals for him out of old furs, and he would throw them into the air and then chase after them, racing with the young dogs. And it usually ended with the fur bear falling into the hearth fire and burning up, with smoke and a foul smell. Nokva would howl, hopping up and down and stomping. And then he would bury his head in his mother's lap. That's where all of his adventures still ended. The maids fought for his favor. The men would pick him up and toss him up to the ceiling whenever they came into the room. If the boy saw Ulf Haldorsson, he would run over and cling to the man's leg. Ulf sometimes took him along out to the farmyard. Erland would snap his fingers at his son and set him on his shoulder for a moment, but he was the one person at Husaby who paid the least attention to the boy. And yet he was fond of Nokva. Erland was glad that he now had two lawfully born sons. Kristin's heart clenched tight. They had taken Björgulf away from her. He whimpered whenever she tried to hold him, and Frida would put him to her own breast at once. His foster mother kept a jealous watch over the boy. But Kristin would refuse to let the new child go. Her mother and Erland had said that she should be spared, and so they took her newborn son away and gave him to another woman. She felt an almost vengeful joy when she thought that their only accomplishment was that she would now be having a third child before Björgulf was even 11 months old. She didn't dare speak of this to Sira Eilif. He would merely think that she was resentful because now she would have to go through all of that again so soon. But that wasn't it. She had come home from her pilgrimage with a deep dread in her soul. Never would that wild desire have power over her again. Until the end of summer, she lived alone with her child in the old house, weighing in her mind the words of the archbishop and Gunulf's speech, vigilantly praying and repenting, diligently working to put the neglected farm in order, to win over her servants with kindness and concern for their welfare, eager to help and serve all those around her as far as her hands and her power might reach. A cool and wondrous peace descended upon her. She sustained herself with thoughts of her father. She sustained herself with prayers to the holy men and women Sira Eilif read to her about, and she pondered their steadfastness and courage. And tender with joy and gratitude, she remembered Brother Edvin, who had appeared before her in the moonlight on that night. She had understood his message when he smiled so gently and hung his glove on the moonbeam. If only she had enough faith, she would become a good woman. When their first year of marriage came to an end, she had to move back in with her husband. Whenever she felt doubtful, she would console herself that the archbishop himself had impressed upon her that in her life with her husband, she should show her new change of heart. And she strove zealously to tend to his welfare and his honor. Erland himself had said, "And so it has happened after all, Kristin. You have brought honor back to Husaby." People showed her great kindness and respect. Everyone seemed willing to forget that she had begun her marriage a little impetuously. Whenever the women gathered, they would seek out her advice. People praised her housekeeping at the manor. She was summoned to assist with weddings and with births on the great estates, and no one made her feel that she was too young or inexperienced or a newcomer to the region. The servants would remain sitting in the hall until late into the evening, just as they did back home at Uringard. They all had something to ask their mistress about. She felt a rush of exhilaration that people were so kind to her, and that Erland was proud of her. Then Erland took charge of the men called up for duty on the ship south of the fjord. He dashed around, riding or sailing, and he was busy with people who came to see him, and letters that had to be sent. He was so young and handsome, and so happy. The listless, dejected look that she had often seen come over him in the past seemed to have been swept away. He sparkled with alertness, like the morning. He had little time left over for her now, but she grew dizzy and wild whenever he came near her with his smiling face and those adventure-loving eyes. She had laughed with him at the letter that had come from Munan Bardsson. The knight had not attended the gathering of the king's retainers himself, but he ridiculed the entire meeting and especially the fact that Erling Vidkunsson had been appointed leader of the realm. But first Erling had probably given himself new titles. No doubt he would want to be called regent now. Munan also wrote about her father. The mountain wolf from Seal crept under a rock and sat there mutely. I mean that your father-in-law took lodgings with the priests at St. Laurentius Church and did not let his fair voice be heard at the discussions. He had in his possession letters bearing the seals of Sir Engisel and Sir Carl Turison. If they haven't yet been worn out, it's because the parchment was tougher than the soles of Satan's shoes. You should also know that Lavrans gave 8 marks of pure silver to Nonaceter. Apparently the man realized that Kristen was not as docile when she was there as she should have been. Kristen felt a stab of pain and shame at this, but she had to laugh along with Erlan. For her, the winter and spring had passed in exhilarating merriment and happiness, with now and then a squall for Orm's sake. Erlan couldn't decide whether he should take the boy north with him. It ended with an outburst during Easter. One night, Erlan wept in her arms. He didn't dare take his son on board for fear that Orm wouldn't be able to hold his own during a war. She had comforted him and herself, and the youth. Perhaps the boy would grow stronger over the years. On the day she rode with Erlan to the anchorage at Birgsea, she couldn't feel either fearful or sad. She was almost intoxicated with him and with his joy and high spirits. At that time, she didn't know she was already carrying another child. When she felt unwell, she had thought, Erlan was so exuberant, there had been so much commotion and drinking at home, and Nokva was sucking the strength out of her. When she felt the new life stir inside her, she had been looking forward to the winter, to traveling to town and around the valley with her bold and handsome husband. She was young and beautiful herself. She had planned to wean the boy by autumn. It was troublesome always having to take him and the nursemaid along wherever she went. She was certain that in this Russian campaign, Erlan would prove fit for something other than ruining his name and his property. No, she had not been glad, and she told this to Sira Ilev. Then the priest had reprimanded her quite sternly for her unloving and worldly disposition. And all summer long she had tried to be happy and to thank God for the new child she was to have, and for the good reports she heard about Erlan's courageous actions in the north. Then he returned home just before Michaelmas, and she saw that he was not pleased when he realized what was to come. He said as much that evening. I thought that when I finally had you, it would be like celebrating Christmas every day. But now it seems that there will be mostly long periods of fasting. Every time she thought about this, the blood would rush to her face, just as hot as on that evening when she turned away from him, flushing deep red and shedding no tears. Erland had tried to make amends with love and kindness, but she couldn't forget it. The fire inside her, which all her tears of remorse had been unable to extinguish, and all her fear of sin could not smother. It was as if Erland had stomped it out with his foot when he said those words. Late that night, they sat in front of the fireplace in Gunnulf's house, the priest and Kristen and Orm. A jug of wine and a few small goblets stood at the edge of the hearth. Master Gunnulf had suggested several times that his guests ought to seek rest, but Kristen begged to stay sitting there a little longer. Do you remember, brother-in-law, she said, that I once told you that the priest back home at Urengard counseled me to enter a cloister if father would not give his consent for Erlan to marry me? Gunnulf glanced involuntarily at Orm, but Kristen said with a wry little smile, Do you think this grown-up boy doesn't know that I'm a weak and sinful woman? Master Gunnulf replied softly, Did you feel a yearning for the life of a nun back then, Kristen? No doubt God would have opened my eyes once I had decided to serve him. Perhaps he thought that your eyes needed to be opened so you would learn that you ought to serve him wherever you are. Your husband, children, and the servants at Husaby need to have a faithful and patient servant woman of God living among them and tending to their welfare. Of course, the maiden who makes the best marriage is the one who chooses Christ as her bridegroom and refuses to give herself to a sinful man. But the child who has already done wrong, I wish that you could have come to God with your wreath, whispered Kristen. That's what he said to me, Brother Edvin Rikertsen, the monk I've often told you about. Do you feel the same way?
Gunnulf Nikolausen nodded. And yet many a woman has pulled herself up from a life of sin with such strength that we dare pray for her intercession. But this happened more often in the past, when she was threatened with torture and fire and glowing tongs if she called herself a Christian. I have often thought, Kristen, that back then it was easier to tear oneself away from the bonds of sin when it could be done forcefully and all at once. And yet we humans are so corrupt. But courage is by nature present in the heart of many, and courage is what often drives a soul to seek God. The torments have incited just as many people to faithfulness as they have frightened others into apostasy. But a young lost child who is torn from sinful desire even before she has learned to understand what it has brought upon her soul, a child placed in an order of nuns among pure maidens who have given themselves up to watch over and pray for those who are asleep out in the world. I wish it would soon be summer, he said suddenly and stood up. The other two looked at him in amazement. Oh, I happened to think about when the cuckoo was singing on the slopes in the morning back home at Husaby. First we would hear one on the ridge to the east, behind the buildings, and then the other would reply from far off, in the woods close to B. It sounded so lovely out across the lake in the stillness of the morning. Don't you think it's beautiful at Husaby, Kristen?
The cuckoo in the east is the cuckoo of sorrow, said Orm Erlandsen quietly.
Husaby seems to me the fairest manor in the world.
The priest placed his hands on his nephew's narrow shoulders for a moment.
I thought so too, kinsman. It was my father's estate for me too. The youngest son stands no closer to inheriting the ancestral farm than you do, dear Orm.
When father was living with my mother, you were the closest heir, said the young boy in the same quiet voice. We are not to blame, Orm, my children and I, said Kristen sorrowfully.
You must have noticed that I bear you no rancor, he replied softly.
It's such an open, wide landscape, said Kristen after a moment. You can see so far from Husaby, and the sky is so vast. Where I come from, the sky is like a roof above the mountain slopes. The valley lies sheltered, round and green and fresh. The world seems just the right size, neither too big nor too small. She sighed, and her hands began fidgeting in her lap.
Was his home there? The man your father wanted you to marry? Asked the priest,
and Kristen nodded.
Do you ever regret that you refused to have him?
He then asked, and she shook her head.
Gunnulf went over and pulled a book from the shelf. He sat down near the fire again, opened the clasps, and began turning the pages.
But he didn't read. He sat with the open book on his lap.
When Adam and his wife had defied God's will, then they felt in their own flesh a power that defied their will. God had created them, man and woman, young and beautiful, so that they would live together in marriage and give birth to other heirs who would receive the gifts of his goodness, the beauty of the Garden of Eden, the fruit of the Tree of Life, and eternal happiness. They didn't need to be ashamed of their bodies because as long as they were obedient to God, their whole body and all of their limbs were under the command of their will, just as a hand or a foot is.
Blushing blood red, Kristen folded her hands under her breast. The priest bent toward her slightly. She felt his strong amber eyes on her lowered face.
Eve stole what belonged to God, and her husband accepted it when she gave him what rightfully was the property of their father and creator. They wanted to be his equal. And they noticed that the first way in which they became his equal was this. Just as they had betrayed his dominion over the great world, so too was their dominion betrayed over the small world, the soul's house of flesh. Just as they had forsaken their Lord God, the body would now forsake its master, the soul. Then these bodies seemed to them so hideous and hateful that they made clothes to cover them. First a short apron of fig leaves. But as they became more and more familiar with their own carnal nature, they drew the clothes up over their heart and their back, which is unwilling to bend. Until today, when men dress themselves in steel all the way to their fingertips and toes and hide their faces behind the grids of their helmets. In this way, unrest and deceit have grown in the world.
Help me, Gunulf, begged Kristin. She was white to the very edge of her lips. I don't know my own will.
They say, thy will be done, replied the priest softly. You know you must open your heart to his love. Then you must love him once more with all the power of your soul.
Kristin abruptly turned to face her brother-in-law. You can't know how much I loved Erland and my children.
Dear sister, all other love is merely a reflection of the heavens in the puddles of a muddy road. You will become sullied too if you allow yourself to sink into it. But if you always remember that it's a reflection of the light from that other home, then you will rejoice at its beauty and take good care that you do not destroy it by churning up the mire at the bottom.
Yes, but as a priest, Gunulf, you have promised God that you would shun these difficulties.
As you have too, Kristin, when you promised to forsake the devil and his work. The devil's work is what begins in sweet desire and ends with two people becoming like the snake and the toad, snapping at each other. That's what Eve learned when she tried to give her husband and her descendants what belonged to God. She brought them nothing but banishment and the shame of blood and death, which entered the world when brother killed brother in that first small field, where thorns and thistles grew among the heaps of stones around the patches of land.
Yes, but you're a priest, she said in the same tone of voice. You're not subjected to the daily trial of trying to agree patiently with the will of another.
And she broke into tears. The priest said with a little smile, about that matter there is disagreement between body and soul in every mother's child. That's why marriage and the wedding mass were created, so that man and woman would be given help in their lives. Married folk and parents and children and house servants as loyal and helpful companions on the journey toward the house of peace.
Kristin said quietly, it seems to me that it would be easier to watch over and pray for those who are asleep out in the world than to struggle with one's own sins.
That may be, said the priest sharply. But you mustn't believe, Kristin, that there has ever been a priest who has not had to guard himself against the fiend at the same time as he tried to protect the lambs from the wolf.
Kristin said in a quiet and timid voice, I thought that those who live among the holy shrines and possess all the prayers and powerful words.
Gunulf leaned forward, tended to the fire, and then sat with his elbows on his knees. It was almost exactly 6 years ago that we arrived in Rome, I, along with two Scottish priests whom we had met in Avignon. We journeyed the whole way on foot. We arrived in the city just before Lent. That's when people in the southern countries hold great celebrations and feasts. They call it Carnevale. The wine, both red and white, flows in rivers from the taverns, and people dance late into the night, and there are torches and bonfires in the open marketplaces. It is springtime in Italy then, and the flowers are blooming in the meadows and gardens. The women adorn themselves with blossoms and toss roses and violets down to the people strolling along the streets. They sit up in the windows, with silk and satin tapestries hanging from the ledge over the stone walls. All buildings are made from stone down there, and the knights have their castles and strongholds in the middle of town. There are apparently no town statutes or laws about keeping the peace in the city. The knights and their men fight in the streets, making the blood run. There was such a castle on the street where we were staying, and the knight who ruled it was named Hermes Malavolti. Its shadow stretched over the entire narrow lane where our hostel stood, and our room was as dark and cold as the dungeon in a stone fortress. When we went out, we often had to press ourselves up against the wall as he rode past, with silver bells on his clothing, and a whole troop of armed men. Muck and filth would splash up from the horse's hooves, because in that country, people simply throw all their slops and offal outdoors. The streets are cold and dark and narrow like clefts in a mountain, quite unlike the green lanes of our towns. In the streets during Carnevale, they hold races. They let the wild Arabian horses race against each other. The priest sat in silence for a moment. Then he continued. This Sir Hermes had a kinswoman living at his house. Isolda was her name, and she might have been Isolde the Fair One herself. Her complexion and her hair were as light as honey, but her eyes were no doubt black. I saw her several times at a window. But outside the city, the land is more desolate than the most desolate heaths in this country, and nothing lives there but deer and wolves, and the eagles scream. And yet there are towns and castles in the mountains all around, and out on the green plains you can see traces everywhere that people once lived in this world. Great flocks of sheep graze there now, along with herds of white oxen. Herdsmen with long spears follow them on horseback. They are dangerous folk for wayfarers to meet, for they will kill and rob them and throw their bodies into pits in the ground. But out on these green plains are the pilgrim churches. Master Gunnulf paused for a moment. Perhaps this land seems so inexpressibly desolate, because the city is nearby. The one that was the queen of the entire heathen world and then became Christ's betrothed. The guards have abandoned the city, which in the teeming din of the feasting seems like an abandoned woman. The revelers have settled into the castle where the husband is absent, and they have lured the mistress into joining their carousing with their merriment and spilling of blood and strife. But underground, there are splendors that are more precious than all the splendors on which the sun shines. That's where the graves of the holy martyrs are, dug into the very rock. And there are so many that the thought of them can make you dizzy. When you remember how numerous they are, the tortured witnesses who have suffered death for the sake of Christ, then it seems as if every speck of dust that is whirled up by the hooves of the revelers' horses must be holy and worthy of worship. The priest pulled out a thin chain from under his robe and opened the little silver cross hanging from it. Inside was something black that looked like tinder moss, and a tiny green bone. One day, we were down in those catacombs all day long, and we said our prayers in caves and oratories where the first disciples of St. Peter and St. Paul once gathered for Mass. Then the monks who owned the church into which we had descended gave us these sacred relics. This is a piece of the sponge which the pious maidens used to wipe up the martyr blood so that it would not be lost. And this is a knuckle from the finger of a holy man. But only God knows his name. Then all four of us vowed that every day we would invoke this holy man, whose honor is unknown to any human. And we chose this nameless martyr as a witness, so that we might never forget how completely unworthy we are of God's reward or the honors of men, and always remember that nothing in this world is worthy of desire, except his mercy. Kristen kissed the cross with deference and handed it to Orm, who did the same. Then Gunnulf said suddenly, "I want to give you this relic, kinsman." Orm sank down on one knee and kissed his uncle's hand. Gunnulf hung the cross around the boy's neck. "Wouldn't you have a mind to see these places, Orm?" The boy's face lit up with a smile. "Yes. I now know that someday I will go there." "Have you ever had a mind to become a priest?" asked his uncle. "Yes," replied the boy. "Whenever father curses these weak arms of mine. But I don't know whether he would like me to be a priest. And then there's that other matter, as you know," he murmured. "Dispensation can be sought for your birth," said the priest calmly. "Perhaps we might journey south together sometime, Orm, you and I."
"Tell me more, uncle,"
Orm implored.
That I will.
Gunnulf put his hands on the armrests of his chair and stared into the fire.
As I wandered there, seeing nothing but reminders of the tortured witnesses and thinking of the intolerable torments they had borne in the name of Jesus, a terrible temptation came over me. I thought about the way the Savior had hung nailed to the cross all those hours. But his disciples had suffered inexpressible torments for many days. Women watched their children tortured to death before their very eyes. Delicate young maidens had their flesh raked from their bones with iron combs. Young boys were forced to confront beasts of prey and enraged oxen. Then it occurred to me that many of these people had suffered more than Christ himself. I pondered this until I felt that my heart and mind would burst. But finally I received the light that I had prayed and begged for, and I realized that just as they had suffered, so should we all have the courage to suffer. Who would be so foolish not to accept pain and torment if this was the way to a faithful and steadfast bridegroom who waits with open arms, his breast bloody and burning with love? But he loved humankind. And that's why he died as the bridegroom who has gone off to rescue his bride from the robber's hands. And they bind him and torture him to death. But he sees his sweetest friend sitting at the table with his executioners, bantering with them and mocking his pain and his loyal love. Gunnulf Nikolausen hid his face in his hands. Then I realized that this mighty love sustains everything in the world, even the fire in hell. For if God wanted to, he could take our souls by force. Then we would be completely powerless in his grasp. But since he loves us the way the bridegroom loves the bride, he will not force her, if she won't embrace him willingly. Then he must allow her to flee and to shun him. I have also thought that perhaps no soul is lost for all eternity, for I think every soul must desire this love. But it seems too dearly bought to let go of every other precious possession for the sake of this love alone. When the fire has consumed all other will that is rebellious and hostile to God, then at last the will toward God, even if it was no bigger in a person than one nail in a whole house, shall remain inside the soul, just as the iron remains in a burned-out ruin.
Gunnulf. Kristen rose halfway to her feet. I'm afraid.
Gunnulf looked up, pale, with blazing eyes. I was also afraid. For I understood that the torment of God's love will never end as long as men and maidens are born on this earth, and that he must be afraid of losing their souls, as long as he daily and hourly surrenders his body and his blood on thousands of altars, and there are those who reject the sacrifice. And I was afraid of myself because I, an impure man, had served at his altar, said mass with impure lips, and held up the host with impure hands. And I felt that I was like the man who led his beloved to a place of shame and betrayed her. He caught Kristen in his arms when she fainted, and he and Orm carried the unconscious woman over to the bed. After a while, she opened her eyes. She sat up and covered her face with her hands. She burst into tears and uttered a wild and plaintive cry.
I can't, Gunnulf, I can't, when you talk like that.
Then I realized that I can never... Gunnulf took her hand, but she turned away from the man's pale and agitated face. Kristen, you cannot settle for anything less than the love that is between God and the soul. Kristen, look around at what the world is like. You who have given birth to two children. Have you never thought about the fact that every child who is born is baptized in blood, and the first thing a person breathes on this earth is the smell of blood? Don't you think that as their mother you should put all your effort into one thing? To ensure that your sons do not fall back on that first baptismal pact with the world, but instead hold on to the other pact, which they affirmed with God at the baptismal font.
She sobbed and sobbed.
I'm afraid of you, she said again. Gunnulf, when you talk like that, then I realize I'll never be able to find my way to peace.
God will find you, said the priest quietly. Stay calm, and do not flee from him who has been seeking you before you even existed in your mother's womb. He sat in silence for a moment near the edge of the bed. Then he asked calmly and evenly whether he should wake Ingrid and ask the woman to come and help her undress. Kristen shook her head. He made the sign of the cross over her 3 times. He bade Orm good night and went into the alcove where he slept. Orm and Kristen undressed. The boy seemed deeply absorbed in his own thoughts. After Kristen was in bed, he came over to her. He looked at her tear-stained face and asked whether he should sit with her until she fell asleep.
Oh, yes. Oh, no, Orm, you must be tired. You who are so young. It must be very late.
Orm stood there a little longer. Don't you think it's strange? He said suddenly. Father and Uncle Gunnulf? They're so unlike each other. And yet they're alike in a certain way. Kristen lay there thinking to herself, yes, perhaps. They're unlike any other men. A moment later she was asleep, and Orm went over to the other bed. He took off the rest of his clothes and crept under the covers. There was a linen sheet underneath and linen cases on the pillows. With pleasure the boy stretched out on the smooth, cool bed. His heart was pounding with excitement at these new adventures which his uncle's words had pointed out to him. Prayers, fasts, everything he had practiced because he had been taught to do so, suddenly seemed new to him. Weapons in a glorious war for which he longed. Perhaps he would become a monk, or a priest, if he could obtain dispensation because he had been born of adultery. Gunnulf's bed was a wooden bench with a sheet made from a hide spread over a little straw and a single small pillow. He had to stretch himself out full length to sleep. The priest took off his surcoat, lay down wearing his undergarments, and pulled the thin homespun blanket over himself. He left the little candle wick burning that was twined around an iron stake. His own words had oppressed him with fear and uneasiness. He felt faint with longing for that time. Would he ever again find that nuptial joy in his heart that had filled him all spring long in Rome? Together with his 3 brothers, he had wandered in the sunshine across the green, flower-starred meadows. He grew weak and trembled when he saw how beautiful the world was. And then to know that all of this was nothing compared to the riches of that other life. And yet this world greeted them with 1,000 small joys and sweet reminders of the bridegroom. The lilies in the field and the birds in the sky reminded them of his words. He had spoken of donkeys like the ones they saw, and of wells like the stone-lined cisterns they passed. They received food from the monks at the churches they visited, and when they drank the blood-red wine and broke off the golden crust from the bread made of wheat, all 4 priests from the barley lands understood why Christ had honored wine and wheat, which were purer than all other foodstuffs that God had given humankind, by manifesting himself in their likeness during the Holy Communion. During that spring he had not felt any uneasiness or fear. He had felt himself released from the temptations of the world to such an extent that when he sensed the warm sun on his skin, then everything he had pondered before with such anguish seemed so easy to comprehend. How this body of his could be cleansed by fire to become the transfigured form. Feeling light and released from the demands of the earth, he needed no more sleep than the cuckoo, dozing in the spring nights. His heart sang in his breast. His soul felt like a bride in the arms of the bridegroom. He realized full well that this would not last. No man could live on earth in this manner for long. And he had received each hour of that bright springtime like a pledge, a merciful promise that would strengthen his endurance when the skies darkened over him and the road led down into a dark ravine through roaring rivers and cold snowdrifts. But it wasn't until he returned to Norway that the uneasiness seized hold of his mind. There were so many things. There was his wealth, the great inheritance from his father, and the richly endowed benefice. There was the path he envisioned before him. His place in the cathedral chapter, he knew it was intended for him, provided he didn't renounce everything he owned, enter the friar's order, take the vows of a monk, and submit to their rules. That was the life he desired, with half his heart. And then when he grew old enough and hardened enough in the battle. In the kingdom of Norway there were people who lived like utter heathens, or were led astray by the false teachings which the Russians put forward in the name of Christianity. The Finns and the other half-wild peoples who were constantly on his mind. Wasn't it God who had awakened in him this desire to journey to their villages, bringing the word and the light? But he pushed aside these thoughts with the excuse that he had to obey the archbishop, and Lord Eilev counseled him against it. Lord Eilev had talked to him and listened to him and shown him clearly that he was speaking to the son of his old friend, Sir Nicholas of Huseby. "But you are not capable of moderation. You who are descended from the daughters of Skogheim's Gaute, whether it be good or bad, whatever you have set your mind to." The salvation of the Finns weighed heavily on the archbishop's heart as well, but they had no need of a spiritual teacher who wrote and spoke Latin as well as his own language, who was no less knowledgeable about the law than about arithmetica and algorithmus. Gunulf had acquired his learning in order to use it, hadn't he? "But it is unclear to me whether you have the gift to talk with the poor and simple people up there in the north." Oh, that sweet spring, when his learning seemed to him no more venerable than a learning that every little maiden acquires from her mother, how to spin and brew and bake and milk, the training that every child needs to tend to his place in the world. He had complained to the archbishop about the uneasiness and fear that came over him whenever he thought about his riches and how much he enjoyed being wealthy. For the needs of his own body he required little. He himself lived like a poor monk. But he liked to see many people sitting at his table. He liked to forestall the needs of the poor with his gifts. And he loved his horses and his books. Lord Eilev spoke somberly about the honors of the church. Some were called to honor it with a stately and dignified demeanor, while others were called to show the world a voluntary poverty. Wealth was nothing in itself. He reminded Gunulf of those archbishops and prelates and priests who had been forced to suffer attacks, banishment, and offenses by kings in the past because they asserted the right of the church. Time after time they had shown that if it was required of Norwegian clergymen, they would renounce everything to follow God. And God himself would give the sign if it should be required, if only they all kept this firmly in sight. Then they need not be afraid that wealth might become an enemy of the soul. All this time, Gunulf noticed that the archbishop was not pleased that he thought and pondered so much on his own. It seemed to Gunulf that Lord Eilev Corten and his priests were like men who were adding more and more bricks to their house. The honor of the church and the power of the church and the right of the church. God knew that Gunulf could be just as zealous as any other priest about matters of the church. He was not one to avoid the work of hauling stones or carrying mortar for the building. But they seemed to be afraid of entering the house and resting inside. They seemed to be afraid of going astray if they thought too much. That was not what he feared. It was impossible for a man to succumb to heresy if he kept his eyes steadfastly fixed on the cross and unceasingly surrendered himself to the protection of the Holy Virgin. That was not the danger for him. The danger was the unquenchable longing in his soul to win the favor and friendship of others. He who had felt in the depths of his being that God loved him, To God, his soul was as dear and precious as all other souls on earth. But here at home, it rose up in him again, the memory of everything that had tormented him during his childhood and youth. That his mother had not been as fond of him as she was of Erlan. That his father hadn't wanted to pay any attention to him, the way he had constantly paid attention to Erlan. Later, when they lived with Bard at Hestness, it was Erland who was praised, and Erland who did wrong. Gunnulf was merely the brother. Erland was the chieftain for all the young boys. Erland was the one the serving maids cursed at and then laughed at just the same. And Erland was the one he himself loved above all others on earth. If only Erland would be fond of him. But he could never be satisfied with the love Erland gave him. Erland was the only one who cared for him. But Erland cared for so many. And now he saw the way his brother handled everything that had fallen to his lot. God alone must know how it would end with the riches of Husaby. There was gossip enough in Nidaros about Erland's imprudent management. To think he took so little notice, when God had given him 4 handsome children, and they were handsome, even the children he had begotten in his dissolute days. Erland perceived this not as a gift of grace, but as something that was simply as it should be. And finally he had won the love of a pure, delicate young maiden of good family. Gunnulf thought about the way Erland had dealt with her. He could no longer respect his brother after he found that out. He grew impatient with himself when he noticed traits he had found in common with his brother. Erland, as old as he was, would turn pale or blush crimson as easily as a half-grown maiden, and Gunnulf would rage because he felt the blood coming and going just as easily in his own face. They had inherited this from their mother. A single word could make her change color. Now Erland assumed it was no more than reasonable that his wife was a good woman, a mirror for all wives, in spite of the fact that year after year he had tried to corrupt this young child and lead her astray. But Erland didn't even seem to imagine that things might be otherwise. He was now married to the woman whom he had trained in sensual pleasures, betrayal, and dishonesty. He didn't seem to think it was something he should honor his wife for. That in spite of her fall, she was still truthful and faithful, modest and good. And yet, when the news arrived this past summer and autumn about Erland's actions in the north, then he had yearned for only one thing, to be with his brother. Erland, the king's military protector in Hålogaland, and he, the preacher of God's words in the desolate, half-heathen districts near the Ganvik Sea. Gunnulf stood up. On one wall of the alcove hung a large crucifix, and in front of it, on the floor, lay a big slab of stone. He knelt down on the stone and stretched out his arms to either side. He had hardened his body to tolerate this position, and he could remain like this for hours, as motionless as stone. With his eyes fastened on the crucifix, he waited for the solace that would come when he was able to focus all his attention on his contemplation of the cross. But the first thought that now came to him was this: should he part with this image? St. Francis and his friars had crosses which they carved themselves from a couple of tree branches. He ought to give away this beautiful rood. He could give it to the church at Husaby. Peasants, children, and women who went there for Mass might gain strength from such a visible display of the Savior's loving gentleness during his suffering. Simple souls like Kristen. For him, it shouldn't be necessary. Night after night he had knelt here with his senses closed off and his limbs numb, until he saw the vision. The hill with the 3 crosses against the sky. The cross in the middle, which was meant to bear the King of heaven and earth, shook and trembled. It bent like a tree in a storm, in fear of bearing the much too precious burden, the sacrifice for all the sins of the world. The Lord of the storm tents forced it, the way a knight forces his defiant stallion. The chieftain of heaven carried it into battle. Then that miracle occurred which was the key to even deeper miracles. the blood that ran down from the cross in redemption for all sins and penance for all sorrows. That was the visible sign. With this first miracle, the eye of the soul could be opened to contemplate those still hidden. God, who came down to earth and became the son of a virgin and brother to the human kin, who lay waste to hell and who, with the released souls that were his spoils of war, stormed toward the dazzling sea of light from which the world was born and which sustains the earth. It was toward that unfathomable and eternal depth of light that his thoughts were drawn, and there they perished in the light, vanishing like a flock of birds into the radiance of an evening sky. Not until the bells of the church rang for matins did Gunnulf get up. There was not a sound as he walked through the main hall. They were both asleep, Kristin and Orm. Out in the dark courtyard, the priest paused for a moment. But none of the servants appeared to accompany him to church. He didn't require them to attend more than two services a day, but Ingrid, his foster mother, almost always went with him to matins. This morning she was evidently still asleep too. Well, she had been up late the night before. All that day the three kinsmen spoke little to each other, and then only about unimportant things. Gunnulf looked tired, but he kept up his bantering just the same. How foolish we were last night. We sat here so mournfully, like three fatherless children, he said once. Many funny little things went on in Nidaros, with the pilgrims and such, which the priests often jested about among themselves. An old man from Heshadol had come to offer prayers on behalf of his fellow villagers, but he managed to mix them all up, and he later realized that things would have looked bad in his village if St. Olav had taken him at his word. Late that evening, Erland arrived, soaking wet. He had come to Nidaros by ship, and now the wind was blowing hard again. He was furious and fell upon Orm at once with angry words. Gunnulf listened for a while and said, "When you speak to Orm in that manner, Erlan, you sound like our father, the way he used to speak to you." Erland abruptly fell silent. Then he shouted, "But I know I never acted so senselessly when I was a boy. Running off from the manor in a snowstorm, a woman who is ill and a whelp of a boy. There's not much else to boast of about Orm's manhood, but you can see that he's not afraid of his father."
"You weren't afraid of father either," replied his brother with a smile. Orm stood before his father without saying a word and tried to look indifferent.
"Well, you can go now," said Erland. "I'm tired of the whole lot at Husaby. But one thing I know. This summer Orm will go north with me. Then I'll make something of this pampered lamb of Kristen's. He's no bumbler either," he said eagerly to his brother. "He has a sure aim, I can tell you that. And he's not afraid. But he's always surly and morose. And it seems as if he has no marrow in his bones."
"If you often rage at your son the way you did just now, then it's not so strange that he would be morose," said the priest. Erlan's mood shifted. He laughed and said, "I often had to suffer much worse from father, and God knows I didn't grow morose from that. It could very well be. But now that I've come here, we should celebrate Christmas, since it's Christmas time, after all. Where's Kristin? What was it she had to talk to you about again that she would?"
"I don't think there was anything she wanted to talk to me about," said the priest. "She had a mind to attend Mass here during Christmas."
"It seems to me that she could have made do with what we have at home," said Erlan. "But it's hard for her. All her youth is being stripped from her in this way."
He rammed one fist against the other.
"I don't understand why our Lord should think we need a new son every year."
Gunnulf looked up at his brother.
"Well, I have no idea what our Lord thinks you may need. But what Kristin no doubt needs most is for you to be kind to her."
"Yes, I suppose she does," murmured Erlan.
The next day, Erlan went to morning mass with his wife.
They set off for St. Gregor's Church. Erland always attended Mass there when he was in Nidaros. The two of them went alone, and in the lane where the snow lay piled up in drifts, heavy and wet, Erland led his wife by the hand, in a refined and courtly fashion. He hadn't said a word to her about her flight, and he had been kind toward Orm after his first outburst. Kristen walked along, pale and silent, with her head bowed slightly. The ankle-length black fur cloak with the silver clasps seemed to weigh heavily on her frail, thin body.
Would you like me to ride back home with you?
Then Orm can travel home by ship, her husband said.
I suppose you would prefer not to travel across the fjord.
No, you know I'm reluctant to journey by ship. The weather was calm and mild now. Every once in a while, mounds of heavy, wet snow would slide down off the trees. The sky hung low and dark gray over the white town. There was a watery, greenish-gray sheen to the snow. The timbered walls of the houses, the fences, and the tree trunks looked black in the damp air. Never, thought Kristen, had she seen the world look so cold and faded and pale. Chapter 3 Kristen sat with Gauta on her lap and stared into the distance from the hill north of the manor. It was such a lovely evening. Below, the lake lay glistening and still, reflecting the mountain ridges, the buildings of Bee, and the golden clouds in the sky. The strong smell of leaves and earth rose up after the rainfall earlier in the day. The grass in the meadows must be knee-deep by now, and the fields were covered with spears of grain. Sounds traveled a long way on such an evening. Now the pipes and drums and fiddles began playing down on the green near Vinyar. They sounded so splendid up on the hill. The cuckoo fell silent for long periods, but then it would cry out a few notes, far away in the woods to the south. And birds whistled and warbled in all the groves around the farm, but sporadic and quiet, because the sun was still high. The livestock were bellowing and their bells were ringing as they returned home from the pasture across from the farmyard gate. Now Gauta will soon have his milk, she cooed to the infant, lifting him up. The boy lay as he usually did, with his heavy head resting on his mother's shoulder. Now and then he would press closer, and Kristen took this as a sign that he understood her endearing words and chatter. She walked down toward the buildings. Outside the main hall, Nokva and Björgulf were leaping around, trying to entice a cat down from the roof where it had taken refuge. Then the boys took up the broken dagger which belonged to both of them and went back to digging a hole in the earthen floor of the entryway. Dagrun came into the hall carrying a basin of goat milk, and Kristen let Gauta drink ladle after ladle of the warm liquid. The boy grunted crossly when the servant woman spoke to him. When she tried to take him away, he struck out at her and hid his face on his mother's breast.
But it seems to me that he's getting better, said the milkmaid.
Kristen cupped the little face in her hand. It was yellowish white, like tallow, and his eyes were always tired. Gauta had a big, heavy head and thin, frail limbs. He had turned 2 years old on the eighth day after St. Lavran's Day, but he still couldn't stand on his own. He had only 5 teeth, and he couldn't speak a word. Sira Iliv said that it wasn't rickets, and neither the alb nor the altar books had helped. Everywhere the priest went, he would ask advice about this illness that had overtaken Gauta. Kristen knew that he mentioned the child in all his prayers. But to her, he could only say that she must patiently submit to God's will. And she should let him have warm goat milk. Her poor little boy. Kristen hugged him and kissed him after the woman had left. How handsome he was. She thought she could see that he took after her father's family. His eyes were dark gray and his hair as pale as flax, thick and silky soft. Now he began to whimper again. Kristen stood up and paced the floor as she held him. Small and weak though he was, he still grew heavy after a while. But Gauta refused to leave his mother's arms. So she walked back and forth in the dim hall, carrying the boy and lulling him to sleep. Someone rode into the courtyard. Ulf Haldorsson's voice.